The Oracle Network.
Hey everyone, I just wanted to let you know that for the foreseeable future, I'm not going to be covering cases doing multi-part series. I'm going to be doing other creator interviews and I'm going to be featuring other podcasts doing feed drops. So I'll be giving you kind of a sampler of other true crime podcasts that I really like. Just due to personal circumstances, it's definitely not doable at the moment to be doing creator interviews and also do The Path Went Chilly and then also cover cases. So I may start up again after Christmas. I'll definitely keep everybody informed and I hope you really enjoy these upcoming interviews. Today's Charlie from Crime Lines. We've got more from Criminology coming up, Aaron from Generation Y, and plenty of others. So today's interview is part one of two, so tune in later in the week to hear part two. Welcome back to this special episode of Riddle Me That. I'm joined by Charlie from Crime Lines, formerly of Insight, and also the writer for Rusty Hinges. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Hi, Jules. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I've recovered from my bat incident this week, so I'm much more comfortable. But you are seeing the studio where the bat flew in and probably was very scared, but I felt like it was an attack and flew around my studio this week. So that was my excitement.
Yeah, Charlie had bats in the belfry for real.
It was really terrible. It was the worst workplace incident of my podcast career.
Yeah, it's pretty terrifying. Okay, so I have to tell you, like, you are one of my favorite podcasters.
Oh, and thank you.
I probably found Insight around the same time you'd started Crime Lines. Mm-hmm. And so I binged like pretty much, I think, every episode. And then I got started on Crime Lines. So what got you started with Insight?
Well, I first started podcasting just out of an interest for having a project and a hobby because I had been homeschooling my older children and they all went back to school. Or to school for the first time for most of them. And so I was home alone with a 2-year-old, and that's not that interesting. And so I needed a project to keep me occupied. So I started a podcast, and it was not true crime related at all. But that got me learning the tech side. So I learned how to edit. And if you know how to edit audio, you are the most desirable co-host in the world. And so when my friend Tim wanted to start a true crime podcast, he was like, oh, hey, you'd be a great co-host. And I'm like, because I know how to edit. I know. I know that it's my editing you want. But that's how Insight started. We got 3 episodes in and Tim dropped out of the project. He had another podcast called History Dweebs. And so he's really busy with that and work. So he dropped out of Insight. And so then the third co-host, Allie, and I just kept it going and it took off. It fit a need. People were at the time, Serial and Gen Y had gotten people really into true crime podcasts and there weren't that many. So people were really looking for them. So you didn't even have to be that good to build an audience, which thank goodness, because in the beginning, we definitely were not that good. Like we wouldn't make it in today's climate of true crime podcasts, starting off with shaky audio, stilted scripting, not really in depth, not the way it is now. So definitely got started at the right time. We started at the same time, Once Upon a Crime, The Vanished, Actual Innocence, Already Gone, The Trail Went Cold, you know, Robin. We all started probably within 6 to 9 months of each other.
What year was that in?
2016. Yeah, I think it would have been 2016 that we started. So between 2015 and 2016, in that post-serial true crime podcast boom, that's when I got started with Insight. And Insight went for, I want to say, almost three years.
Wow, that's a lot. What was the first true crime podcast you listened to? Was it Gen Y?
Well, I listened to Serial, but I didn't think of Serial as a podcast because I listened to This American Life on the radio. So I felt like I was listening to This American Life, but on my phone. So I didn't even realize you could listen to NPR on your phone like that. So that was news to me. So Serial would be the first one. But once I was like, wait, on demand content? All right, I love this. And then I went to Generation Y, and Thinking Sideways was another really early one that I was into.
Oh, I love Thinking Sideways. When I first discovered podcasts, I was like, oh, I just love this. They talk about so much fun, like kind of conspiracy things, not just strictly true crime.
Yes, they would do all sorts of things, which is what made it nice. And it was also an easy listen because they weren't ever going to cover anything complicated. Like, and if it was complicated, which they did Lake City Quiet Pills, which is extremely complicated, but they did it light and conversationally, and you weren't having to, you know, go back 30 seconds to rehear something. So I mean, I still listen to their old episodes sometimes to go to sleep, which is funny because I know them now. I've met them a few times. I was out in Portland hanging out with them right before the pandemic. And so you would almost think that would take some of the shine off of it, but it absolutely hasn't. I still like listening to it and listening to them. And I loved that show.
It's so funny that you bring up Lake City Quiet Pills, because that's probably my most memorable episode of Thinking Sideways, because I'd never heard of it before. I'd listened to it on the show and I was like, what the actual F is going on here?
Yeah. And that Lake City, whatever ammunition or whatever it is, that's here in the KC metro area. So I was like, oh, I need to go out there and explore and figure out what's going on. And then I like couldn't find it. And it was a whole thing. But yeah, that episode was, I liked when they did internet mysteries because those are very interesting, but there's not that many out there. I know there's another podcast called Clouded and he does internet mysteries, but they're all like 10-minute episodes. So sometimes, I mean, I appreciate any length episode. I definitely don't want to sound like I don't appreciate it. But sometimes if an episode is short, it just doesn't feel satisfying, even if they told you the whole story. Even if the whole story is just 10 minutes and 10 good minutes, it still kind of feels like I want more with shorter episodes.
I don't like to listen to anything. This sounds so weird, but anything shorter than like 50 minutes. I'm like, that's too short. I don't know why. That's like my barometer for the perfect length. And it can be longer. It could be up to like 2 hours, but it needs to be 50 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, Crime Lines is almost always some of my cases when I cover, especially small. Sometimes I'll get contacted by families who are looking for coverage, which means there's not a lot out there. And they're often cases where the police haven't released anything. So there's also not a lot for me to do except tell their story. And those tend to be shorter. A lot of my missing and murdered Indigenous women cases will only be 30 to 40 minutes. But for the most part, Crime Lines, as much as I keep saying, I need to find shorter cases because this weekly grind of hour-long content is just a lot. And sometimes I'm like, I need shorter cases just to have a little bit of, you know, a little bit more balance in my life, but I'm just not that person. So I'm always like, oh, I'm more interested in the longer cases. So that's what I'm mostly doing. But when I write for Rusty Hinges, those episodes are like 20 minutes. And I always think, well, there are 20 minutes every 1 to 3 months we release one. And people have to be like, how did it take you 3 months to get 20 minutes of content? But I swear it does. It's just a different show. And I think if I was a listener of Rusty Hinges, I would really hate me. Like I would be like, this show is so good. Why aren't you putting more out? But we just can't get it done.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the show?
About Rusty Hinges? Yeah. It's definitely different than Crime Lines. It's scripted, but I have someone who does voiceover on it. So the host is more of a character than like a real person. I mean, he's a real person. I'm married to him. We have 6 children together, but he is kind of a persona on the podcast. And it's weird history and true crime. We almost always do historic stuff because you can't, it's hard to laugh about anything that happened too recently that was a tragedy. We have a lot of people who are like, I only listen to your true crime ones. We have a lot of people who are like, I only listen to your not true crime ones. So we try to mix it up to give everybody a little of what they want. But it's a comedy light podcast. It's not too heavy. We purposely avoid really heavy topics because we are purposely avoiding making fun of anything too dark. We do have some murder cases in there, but Our last one was on Sid Finch, which is a, I can't tell you what it is or it'll give away the punchline. But anyway, if people know who Sid Finch is, they know what it's about. So, anyway, they're funny. They're like, we did Balloon Boy, which I mean, that was, yeah, maybe there was a crime element. They got charged, but nobody got hurt, you know? So that's about the most recent thing we would do is a recent, maybe hoax kind of thing. But other than that, we try to avoid that darker true crime. I do all of that on Crime Lines.
So what got you started and like motivated to do Crime Lines after Insight ended?
So I was done at the time Insight ended. I was already working for Parcast writing for them. And I was writing for Canadian True Crime at the time. I did some work for Court Junkie for her Patreon bonus episodes. And I was constantly getting contacted by people saying, okay, what do you charge for writing? I'll pay it. And I thought, maybe I just make my career writing other people's podcasts because you get paid whether they sell an ad spot or not. That sounds great. I'll do that. And so I was going to move towards doing that and just kind of stop the podcast voicing side of things. And then when Insight was ending and we were wrapping up, we had a bunch of scripts that I had written that we just hadn't recorded yet. And so we were using those to kind of fill out the time between when we decided to end it until we were done. And so we probably got another 6 weeks out of it because I had all these scripts that were either done or in some state of research and I wanted to finish. Well, we did some of them together. I got guest hosts for some of them. And then 1 week, I was supposed to record it with somebody and they did it. They weren't able to do it at the last minute. So I had pretty much no choice but to like record it by myself or not get paid because we had ads on it. And I was like, well, I'm just going to record it by myself and it's going to be terrible, but we'll just do it. And then I did it by myself and literally the emails and the messages, they just came like pouring in where they're like, wait, you could do this by yourself. Just do it by yourself. This was totally fine. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not okay. I mean, if it sounded okay. And I also had some other podcasters in my ear who kind of tough loved me a little bit. They're like, you have a feed with tens of thousands of people subscribed to it who are listening every week, who don't care what you put on it. They're going to listen. And you're going to, and you have ads and you have money coming in. You're just going to walk away from that. They're like, just think about it. Like, don't shut it down. Just wait. And so it was just kind of a, they were in my ear. And then I had this successful solo venture and I decided, okay, maybe I can go ahead and do this. And so I looked at continuing. I took a month off so I could kind of get everything together and kind of got annoyed that I blew through those 6 scripts I had for Insight because I was like, I could have used those for Crime Lines. But I did start Crime Lines. And at first, Insight, you would listen to Insight and then Crime Lines picked up right when it ended. I have since taken all of the Insight episodes and moved them to a different feed because I was getting a lot of people who would listen to an early one. Because there are a lot of people who go to the first episode you've put out. Even when you have hundreds of episodes, they listen to the first one. And I was getting reviews referring to one of those. And I was like, well, that's not where I am anymore. So I did move Insight. You can still listen to the Insight episodes. They're just some, you just have to go look for them. Just search for it in your podcast app. And then Crime Lines is its own thing and has been for about 2.5 years now. So it's been a journey.
So you've done a lot for missing and murdered Indigenous women cases. Like you do your, for those of you who aren't familiar with Crime Lines, Charlie does a monthly missing and murdered Indigenous women mm-hmm. and girls case. What was the genesis for your interest in these types of cases?
I have a general interest in vulnerable populations and undercovered people who need, maybe don't necessarily need the coverage because their case is solved, but those where their case isn't solved and there's no eyes on it and there's no pressure. And I really have to say, I don't know if you listen to being, you know, British Columbia, if you listen to the Island Crime podcast. They did an entire season on Lisa Marie Young. And I listened to it when it came out. And then Lisa's friend asked me if I would cover it. So I will be doing that in an upcoming episode. But after that, that podcast got people to come forward with tips. It generated more. I don't want to act like the RCMP weren't doing anything, but it definitely kind of pushed some more active action. It was after that podcast came out that all of a sudden there's another search happening and there's a this happening and a that happening. And I really think that there's a power in media to put pressure, not just on the public to come forward with what they know, but also holding investigators accountable for these cold cases. And when you're talking about the missing and murdered Indigenous women cases, there are statistically for the population more of them. And then there's also less attention to them. And so I have talked to family members who have unsolved cases that are, in my opinion, solvable if there was a little bit more work being done on them.
So I'm going to segue into a case that I know means a lot to you. But before I go there, what do you think is going on in Montana? Because there seems to be an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
I 100% believe that Bighorn County would kick me out if I showed up after. Because someone sent me a case out of Bighorn County and I'm like, ooh, I'm not their favorite. But yeah, I think the issue with Montana is an issue that we see in a lot of states that are not densely populated. There is a lot of land, not a lot of people, therefore not a lot of police officers. And there is also a bit of a disconnect between local jurisdictions and reservation police. And the reservation police are technically under the federal government in the United States, and the city police and county police and state police are under the state governments. So there are issues with communication and interjurisdictional working together. Now, I covered Caitlin Kelly, which is a Wisconsin case where it was fantastic. Like, she was last seen on the reservation, but her apartment was off the reservation, and the police forces from both worked together. Amazing. I mean, they did such a great job. She was found, unfortunately, deceased. But the working together and the communication was there. It is not always there. And I think that is a big issue in Bighorn County, is that you can respect the sovereignty of the reservation and also talk to them. Like, it's not like you either or. And I know they had that issue in New Mexico with the Amber Alert system. And Ashlyn Mike, her Amber Alert went out late, very late, even though they had all of this information, because her brother actually was kidnapped with her, but got away. So they had a description of the kidnapper. They knew what his car looked like. If I'm remembering correctly, it was a van. They knew all this stuff, but it was on the reservation, and the state police issue Amber Alerts, and the reservation and the state police have no jurisdictional connection. And so it got delayed, and it wouldn't have saved her, but it could have brought the case to closure faster. And it didn't. And so there is working on the Amber Alert in Indian Country to solve that problem. But yeah, so Montana, too big, not enough people, not enough police, and not enough communication. That's the long answer to what I think is happening in Montana.
So let's talk a little bit about KSARA Stops Pretty Places. Mm-hmm. I know this is the one case that to you, it deserves all the coverage in the world. And there's just so many issues with this.
One of the things I think KSARA's case, obviously, I think her family deserves answers, but they deserve not just answers to what happened, because we know that those answers don't always come. There's not always, not all cases are going to be solved. I understand that. So I want a solve for them. I want answers for them. But they deserve so many more answers. They deserve answers about the coroner. They deserve answers about the state's attorney. They deserve answers about the police, both in Bighorn County and on the reservation, they deserve answers from Kaysera's friends who were there, who they barely got their names after how long? It's been 2 years since she was found, and they pretty much just got their names recently. They deserve a holistic approach to answers, not just what happened to Kaysera. And when I started working on that, at the time I was working with a researcher who's Indigenous, and she's the one who talked to Grace Bulltail, Kaysera's aunt, and did a lot of that work. Well, I went and did kind of more the jurisdictional, you know, research and just the systemic issues up there. And I found so much that I was like, how is this happening? How is the funeral director and the coroner the same person? How is someone working in Bighorn County as a coroner and as a funeral director and doesn't know or respect Indigenous customs when it comes to funerals and burials? How is that? How does he not? How can I? Like, it's on Google. Like, Google it. Like, come on, Terry Bullish, just Google it. So I just, there's so much there that is a problem. And it's not just Kaysera's case. It's when I looked at Kaysera's case, I saw all the other cases and all the other issues and all the other questions. And there is something not okay in Bighorn County, Montana. There is a lot not okay. And I think it's if Kaysera's case is the one that's the catalyst for the change, then that's great. But something has to be, because nothing has been. But I think they didn't know what they were getting into with Grace Bulltail, Kaysera's aunt, who is going to figure this out. And it's really interesting in the way Kaysera was raised was in a more traditional sense, where her aunts weren't, the family unit is more your cousins or your siblings, your aunts or your moms, you know. So she had this connection to all of these people. So when I say in the episode, I call Grace her aunt, I'm like, well, that's like the term we use. However, she's more like her mom. And then this grandmother is also more like her mom. And it's like Kaysera had a lot of people who loved her. And I don't think they realized how much pushback they were going to get from the family. I think that surprises some investigators in some places get surprised when they look at a victim, they size it up, and they don't expect they're going to get pushback. I think the same thing happened, which, to shift it completely the other way, DJ Ficky, he was killed, and they ruled it a suicide, which is the most ridiculous thing in the world. There were witnesses to it not being a suicide, and they still, it's you know that case. It's a long story on how it happened. But when I spoke with the private investigator working on it, he said they saw a meth user in a trap house shot to death, and they didn't realize he had a whole family behind him who were going to come in and demand answers. And they didn't do what they needed to at the scene because they didn't think it was going to matter. And as we know from DJ's sister, who is a fierce advocate, it did matter. It mattered a lot. And DJ has an entire family ready to fight for him. And she has done more than I have seen a lot of families get done, including getting the case reopened. Getting a suicide ruling, to get a case like that reopened, is almost impossible. And so I think that that's what happened in Kaysera's case. They saw what they labeled a troubled teen, which is also not accurate, but that's how they labeled her. And she came from a family where she wasn't living necessarily with her parents. And sometimes she lived with this aunt, sometimes she lived with grandma. And they didn't realize that that was not indicative of how much her family was going to fight for her.
It's just so unfortunate. So for anybody listening, just to give you a refresher on the case, Kaysera was at a party when she disappeared, right? And there was a man and a woman who were a couple, apparently engaged in like a domestic violence type situation. Mm-hmm. Kaysera and her friend stuck around to make sure the woman was all right. Then they hear a cop car and they all disperse. The friend later goes back to this home, and the man basically won't let her search, won't let her look around the area. And then it's what, 5 days later that Kaysera's body is discovered, maybe wrapped in plastic, maybe not. In the yard, in a heavily trafficked, nice area where there's, you know, joggers going by, cars going by. She should have been seen if she was there for 5 days.
That is absolutely true. And the house where she was found, she was in a backyard, but that was like facing the street. That yard was facing the street. When I heard backyard, I thought, well, maybe. No, it's a it's not a huge property. It's a normal size yard. A jogger spotted her. So, you know, there were questions early on. When did the homeowners last mow their lawn? When were they out back? Because that would be a good question to, and that was a big question mark. And yeah, Kaysera was found. There is no evidence of injury, foul play, but there's also no evidence of a natural cause or even an accident. Like, it looks like, according to the official account, they just don't know what happened. And she was found. They did not identify her for almost 2 weeks. And the family was actively looking for her at that time. And somehow nobody put the cases together until they normally, what we see, if remains are found, the family will be notified by the police of what they found. Often they'll be told whether there's a chance, or they'll be like, remains were found, but it's a man. It's not your missing daughter. We just want you to know because you're going to see it in the media and we don't want you to freak out. That's the proper way to go about it. This way, they didn't contact until they had like confirmation it was her. And so they didn't find out until I think like September 11th. So she had gone missing on, I think, the 24th, the 29th she was found, and then the 11th is when they finally, the family who had been actively searching for her, finally heard that the body had been found.
And wasn't it one of Kaysera's aunts, I don't know if it was Grace or if it was the other aunt, who was on the scene and basically said, there's a body found, this could be Kaysera, can I identify the body? And they're like, oh, not her.
Yeah, there was a lot of confusion early on. And there's also, when I covered the case, it had been not that long. I mean, it had been like maybe, I want to say 6 months, maybe 7 months. So I covered it fairly early on. And back at that point, the family didn't even, it wasn't even clear who knew what and who made what call and who did what. Because there are, like I said, this is a big family. Everyone's connected. Everyone's trying to do everything. And there is some indication that a family member did contact the police and were basically brushed off, and which made them continue searching. So it was, I mean, it was a very difficult situation for the family because, like I said, there's more questions than just what happened to Kaysera. Why is the family being treated this way? Why are they not given information? Why is Terry Bullis still allowed to have a job? Like, I have so many questions for them, and Bighorn County isn't really answering them.
It's like a major conflict of interest that Terry Bullis is the coroner, but he also has, you know, the Bullis mortuary. And it seemed that he applied pressure early on to, was it Geraldine? Mm-hmm. And he'd said, if you want Kaysera's remains back, in a way that is completely insensitive to, you know, the indigenous culture and beliefs, you have to have her cremated, which just wasn't true. But yet he seemed to apply pressure for one reason or another.
And we're always dealing with a grieving family in these moments. So at someone's like darkest moment, they're told something that doesn't really make sense, but they may not process that because they're in this dark place. They're grieving. And so the fact that, you know, doing that thing and saying, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense, let me look into that. You're not thinking that way when you're burying a child. You don't think like that. And so, yeah, there was a lot of pressure from that. He had, you know, I had found some things I sent, the family now has access to, about him being suspected and even at one point, like, investigated for using his role as a coroner to like funnel business to himself. And that's a massive issue. And like I said, if you're going to be a coroner or a funeral director in a area with a large Indigenous population, why do you not know the customs? Why are you pushing for something that you know goes against their customs?
And it was what, in Bighorn County, something like 65% of the residents are Indigenous?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Bighorn County, the way it's laid out, the reservation is a big chunk of land, and the county kind of, if I'm picturing it correctly, it's been a couple of years, like I said, since I covered this, but it kind of like horseshoes around it. So there are people like, so the reservation, if people move off the reservation, the odds are they're moving to Hardin or they're moving to one of those cities that are in Bighorn County. So it has one of the highest Indigenous populations in the country. And so you would think that he would know what he's supposed to do.
But there's a legacy in Bighorn County, right? Of the Bullis men and the Bullis family, both being coroners.
His dad owned the funeral home before him and was the coroner until he became the coroner. Now, the coroner situation is a little messy because it is an elected position. And so if they can't, if nobody else is willing to do the job, they can't make someone do the job. So part of it is also that if they don't have a lot of people in the area and they're not qualified to be coroner, which actually isn't that hard because you don't have to be a medical examiner. I did find, to Terry Bullis's credit, if I'm willing to, I'm pretty sure I had this in my episode just because I was like, I should say something nice about him. He does send a decent number of cases to the medical examiner. Coroners can rule right there with no autopsy, nothing, but he does have a record of sending more than average to the medical examiner, which is good. I mean, that is something we want to see. The fact that if he's using his position to funnel business to himself, that is not good. But in this case, I'm pretty sure I remember him being one of the top in the state to send cases to medical examiner. So that was good.
Yeah, you did address that in your episode specifically. And I did find that point really interesting. But also, Terry Bullis taking the body before it was forensically investigated. That is such a weird part of the story.
Yeah, so I brought my script up. So I want to make sure I don't get sued for defamation and say anything I shouldn't say about Terry Bullis. But yeah, they had the issue with the body going back and forth. And then finally, they had the issue with him demanding that, he's saying they have to. So I said Terry Bullis had a complaint against him. And I do want to clarify for the record that the complaint was that there was an issue with his embalming, and he embalmed and he wouldn't release a body until they paid him. The family paid him. And that is the business he did that he got a complaint against him for. So I just wanted to clarify that before I said something wrong.
I think that's a fair point to make too, because the family of Kay Sarah, they wanted to use another funeral home, but Terry mm-hmm. Bullis basically applied pressure and was like, you need to do it here, or something to that effect. I'm not saying he said that exactly, but.
Right. And the other issue is that Gerilyn was not Kay Sarah's legal guardian. So while those things culturally, there's, and I know it's in Canada as well, that in Canada, thankfully, has a procedure in place to recognize cultural guardianship, which the U.S. does not have. But regardless of who Kay Sarah may have been staying with when she was in Hardin, her grandmother, Yolanda, had legal guardianship of her. So the fact that they had the issue with the investigators and the funeral home going to family members who did not have legal guardianship. And so that was also a problem. And it could have been their own confusion, but that's something they should ask. They should at least ask to make sure that the person saying this has the authority to say and do it.
It feels like they just didn't ask enough, or they didn't communicate enough. Like, there was no back and forth between the family. And when they said that they were filing missing persons reports, that didn't happen. And then early on, they said, you can't file a missing persons report. It just seemed to be incorrect information given to the family. And then later on, there just was no communication, no information flow back and forth.
Yeah. And that continued, and it continues today, because they finally got a report from the state's attorney, and Grace went over it in detail. And one of the things they noted was that Kaycera had an elevated blood alcohol level. They give what the level is. I want to say it was 0.16, maybe. It was in the intoxicated range. But then they give absolutely no context, like the fact that she wasn't found for 5 days and blood alcohol levels increase after death. So 0.16, you are twice the legal limit to drive. Well, she wasn't driving. You know what? So that's not 0.16 is intoxicated. However, they couldn't have done that test until at least 5 days after death when it could rise. And so Grace consulted experts in this, and all of them looked at it and said, not a big deal. 0.16, 5 days after death. That's not like blackout alcohol poisoning drunk. Not at all. Well, none of that context was in the state's attorney report. I find that what people choose to put in a report and what they choose to elaborate on and what they choose to just state as blank fact also says something. So I agree with Grace that there should have been some context given to that number.
Yeah, I think I heard an expert talk about this, an expert in toxicology, and they were saying that you can only get an accurate read on toxicology on blood alcohol level. I think it was 48 or 72 hours after death. Mm-hmm. Because after that, the body starts this kind of fermentation process where the blood alcohol naturally rises. So we can only guesstimate her blood alcohol might have only been 0.08. It could have been 0.02. Mm-hmm. We just don't know that for a fact. And like you said, they're giving zero context and they're making it sound like, oh, she was very intoxicated. When in reality, it's likely elevated to this level because they did this testing so late.
Yeah. And I mean, nobody's sitting here saying she wasn't out with friends having a drink, but to try to make the death, to try to come up with a reason, the 0.16 doesn't really, 5 days after death does not give us a reason.
Definitely not. And the fact that they were operating and like right straight in the media, it seems, or like out there saying, when you test her blood alcohol or test, you know, do a toxicology panel, you're going to find either elevated, you know, blood alcohol levels, or you're going to find elevated drug levels, which seems like a pretty extreme conclusion to jump to without speaking to the family.
Yes. And so we always have this discussion in true crime circles, how much the police should release, how much they should hold back, and are they holding back too much? Well, I definitely think that some of the conjecture done, It was not necessary to any of this. But the family has really, really worked to try to get information. And they finally, I mean, they have made headway. I don't want to make it sound like they're talking into the void and they're not getting anything back. What they're getting back isn't enough, but they have pushed. The only reason they've gotten anything is because they've pushed. And currently, they are doing a even bigger push right now. They did a walk to the building. They did a virtual things on the Facebook page so that people who weren't there could watch and see. They did memorial type things, advocacy type things, and they're currently still doing it, encouraging people to write a letter to the state's attorney and let him know what you think should be done. Now, those letters can come from anywhere. They don't have to be Montana residents, but they do mean more if you are a Montana resident, or you're especially a Bighorn County resident, and you let them know that you want more done. Because, I mean, you're the reason they have their jobs.
Another thing that was really, really baffling about this, when I covered it with Chelsea from Crime and Crime Again, in her research, she came up with the fact that she didn't think the investigators had questioned the individual whose backyard Kaycera's body was discovered in, as well as the jogger who had discovered the body.
They definitely, that was a huge question in the, and you know, like I brought up, like, when did he mow his lawn last? When was he last out there? I believe there is some indication he was out of town the night Kaycera went missing. So the night she would have ended up in the backyard, if that's what happened, that night he may have been out of town. I'm not 100% sure on that. But yeah, there was not a lot of it. Whatever questioning they did with him, they did not release it to the family, because the family, when I talked to them, had all of these questions, and they actually had a trouble finding out where exactly. They found out what neighborhood it was. They didn't know which yard it was. They had to go find it themselves.
Because like how you spoke about with DJ Ficky's case at what could have been very likely a crime scene, they didn't follow proper protocols and procedures. No. They didn't cordon it off.
Yeah. And I know, I believe the family personally has spoken with the jogger. I think he has talked to them. But, you know, some of the details are blurry because it's been a while since I covered, you know, the details of it. But yeah, there's also a possibility that's a little bit trickier that some of Kaysera's family in Hardin may also have information that they were maybe not necessarily willing to, what they knew like about who she was with and where she was going and things like that. I know when my researcher did her interviews and sent me the information, I did have her go back to the person who said that they were concerned that family members weren't saying as much as they should, to make sure that that was cleared to be in the episode, because I don't want to cause a rift in a family that's already dealing with so much. But there was, for instance, when Grace was trying to figure out what happened, where Kaysera was, where she was, where she went, she hadn't been told that Kaysera had left with people. And she like learned that online. Like she didn't even get that from her family members. So there were some issues with that early on. I do hope they've resolved that and feel like everybody's saying everything. But it's not that anyone's necessarily in the family hiding something for like nefarious reasons. We leave things out for all sorts of reasons. It's the cases where a kid goes missing from their yard and the parent says, oh, I just popped in for like 2 minutes. And I'm like, or you were inside for 15 and you're kind of trying to make it sound like you weren't left or you didn't leave your kid outside as long as you did. That doesn't mean the parent did anything. It just means they're trying to present themselves in the most positive light. So, I mean, there is some of that could be happening, but I do think that not all of the people Kaysera was with that night, but I do believe at least one, likely two of them know a whole lot more than they're saying, like a whole lot more.
Because the one that you're referring to, the young woman that she was with, that was part of the couple that was involved in the altercation, she was related to Kaysera by blood. Like one of her aunts was like the aunt of this young woman, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, there were. So when I did my episode, the names of all of the people Kaysera was with were not known, but it was just that there was a minor friend and there were also some adults involved. But at first it was like, what do we mean adults? Because if we're talking 17, 18 year olds with a 20 year old, yeah, the 20 year old's an adult. But are we talking like a 40 year old? Well, it turns out it is younger adults is what we're talking about here. I don't believe there were any older adults involved. I mean, not directly involved, at least not people that Kaysera was with. And then with that kind of altercation, argument, whatever, someone also set off like a car alarm to try to like spook everyone, because it was like really late at night, early morning hours, and everyone ran. And so the official story is Kaysera ran off into a yard and they never saw her again. And it's like, that doesn't sound right. This isn't the woods. This isn't a field. This isn't any of that. It's summer. It's not, Montana. Yeah, you can die from exposure, but in August, like August overnight, you're fine. Like, I mean, they did note in the state attorney report that Kaysera does have asthma. Maybe she ran off and had an asthma attack, but why would she end up curled up in someone's backyard? Like, why wouldn't she have run to a house or gone somewhere where she could have gotten help? It doesn't really make sense. But I will say the attorney's report does specify that they cannot rule out asphyxiation because that wouldn't necessarily leave marks. So so they're not saying, you know, they wouldn't know if it was an asthma attack, asphyxiation, or someone smothered her. Like they wouldn't be able to tell. And due to the state of her remains when she was found, there were no obvious signs, but those can also be obscured
And it was August, right? So mm-hmm. if she had been dead for 5 days, like mm-hmm. finding a cause of death becomes more difficult. And they didn't autopsy her body right away, did they? Like, it took a considerable amount of time after the fact, or am I incorrect?
Because, well, they had sent her. So she ended up in the funeral home, and then they went and they got her, and then they were supposed to get her back. And that's when the whole cremation thing happened, because they were able to view her body at one point, but they were sitting there at the funeral home, kept being told, oh, it'll be another 45 minutes. It'll be another 45 minutes. Like, it was a whole thing. So they did autopsy her, but I mean, they didn't find her for 5 days. I don't know when the autopsy was done, because they did the dental comparisons. It's possible they may not have done the autopsy until after that, which would have, after they had an identification, but I'm not sure. I'd have to go look at my script again.
It's just so strange that the home of the man or the couple, when mm-hmm. Kaysera's friend goes back and she wants to search, like, not only does he shut her down, which, if you have nothing to hide, like, why don't you just let the girl look around? She's worried mm-hmm. about her friend. But he chases them, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not 100% clear on that sequence of events of what happened. But I do know that they tried to, according to one of the people Kaysera was with, someone did go back and look for her, or try to look for her, and wasn't able to. Yeah, I don't know how far through the neighborhood they looked, because from what I understand, the yard she was found in was not the yard where everything was happening, and not the neighbor who tried to chase everybody away, but someone else.
So what do you think, like, to compare and contrast the way that Kaysera's case was handled versus Selena Not Afraid? Because you speak about this in your episode a little bit.
I will say that, so I try not to speak too much on Selena's case. I mean, I mentioned it in my episode, and I felt like I did some research on it, but I do think I was missing some things. Like, you know, when you're doing a deep dive in a case and you're bringing in just kind of a side case. But one of the things with Selena Not Afraid is that they were able to get a cause of death for her a lot faster for the family. And one of the questions there is that, so they said she died of hypothermia. And one question is that she went missing after Kaysera did, but she went missing in the winter. So had Kaysera been found in the winter, would they have just chalked it up to hypothermia? Like, and they couldn't do that because it was August. I kind of, you know, you would think they would be able to, they would have something more. But Selena Not Afraid, that is a case I really want to get into more. I do believe someone's covered it recently, a podcast. I can't remember who, though. I don't know if you've heard one.
I haven't. I've heard little snippets about the case, and I need to go and search it on Spotify so I can listen to an episode, because it seems so sketchy that, like, this van was having mm-hmm. trouble, or vehicle was having trouble, and they just, like, leave her and her friend because it wasn't going to be a safe ride. It's like, well, aren't they safer inside a vehicle in wintertime, even if it breaks down?
Than by themselves on the side of a road or on a rest stop or wherever they left her. I mean, the main difference I think with Selena and Kaysera's case, at least how the investigation went to start, was that Selena's case got a grid search. Where Kaysera, her family was having to search for her. They weren't getting that kind of response from the police. But with Selena Not Afraid, there was a grid search very early on. And one possibility is that she is related to the sheriff of Bighorn County. But I mean, maybe he acted faster because they're related. But on the other hand, I'm under the impression that it was like a extended relation, which in Native communities like this, you're often related somehow to a lot of people, you know, so it's not like I was under the impression that this was like her uncle or anything, just a more extended relation. So it's not clear. The other thing is that when Kaysera went missing, the police, the sheriff's department was undergoing some sort of reorg. Something was going on with it. Now, 4 months later, when Selena went missing, that was probably done. You know, they probably had already finished that. So it may also have been they were just on the ball more. I I don't know. It's really hard to say why one case hits and one doesn't when you look at the circumstances and they seem so similar. And I mean, it's even the same area. So, yeah.
It's such a confounding case. And I think you mentioned that she had a friend with her and the friend was found, but like not mm-hmm. remembering all of the details. And
yes. Yeah. That was the, it's always hard when you come across a case where someone's like, yes, I was with this person right before they went missing, but I don't know what happened to them next. And that is the Lisa Marie Young case, which I'm working on right now. That literally happened. She got in a car with a guy and he's like, I don't know. I dropped her off. Like, I mean, there's, it's like, wait, you got to know more than that. I know that we are currently both following that case with the cross country van life people and the boyfriend. I don't know if they were engaged.
Yeah, they keep calling him the fiance and then the boyfriend, Gabby Petito. Yeah.
Yes. And so that's a very new case where he showed up earlier this month with the van, but without her. And the apparently hasn't told her family what happened. Like not cooperating with police, but literally not even telling the family, like, oh, we got in a fight and she got out of the van, or she was going to take a bus home, like nothing. And so, you know, you always have to wonder when the last person to see somebody is just like, I don't know. You got to know something.
For sure. And I think everyone
saw them walk away. I mean, say something.
Go to the police and at least have your lawyer make a statement to them about yes. what happened and be like, she got out at this point. I don't know what happened to her or whatever. But in our little group on Twitter, like everyone's just been posting that nonstop, yeah. right? And CJ just posted something about how the couple that was in the same area, the newlyweds that were murdered, mm-hmm. that it was a lesbian couple, because we were talking about why is this case so full of intrigue and why does the media, you know, have such an attachment to finding mm-hmm. out what happened. And it's like, well, for one, Gabby Petito is deserving of all of the attention, but she is mm-hmm. the quote unquote ideal victim, right? Yeah. So she has the, you know, blonde hair, light eyes, pale skin, and it makes every news outlet practically salivate because they're like, this is going to sell mm-hmm. a lot of papers. It's going to get a lot of clicks. They just see dollar signs. And I'm not saying that they don't care and that they're not invested in the outcome. Right. But we don't see that for persons of color often mm-hmm. or LGBTQ plus cases.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually really interesting to have heard that there was a murder of a newlywed couple in that same area that didn't get any attention. And it's like, well, that's interesting. And then it's like, oh, well, a lesbian couple. So, but isn't she also a, some kind of YouTuber influencer with her van life thing? I think I,
yeah, hashtag van life. I listened to the Going West podcast on it.
Okay.
It went through all the different posts that they had made. And it's just like, mm-hmm. both of them were talking about like loving hashtag van life with Gabs Petito and vegetables, yoga, and sunshine. And like, it seemed like they were on that sort of a path. And I mean,
yeah.
I don't know necessarily what their mental health was like. Somebody had posted mm-hmm. in group that, and I don't know, I didn't see the direct link, so I don't know how, I can't judge the veracity of the statement, but they were saying that they each had a mental health condition and they weren't taking medications. Mm-hmm. So if that's true, that could have been a big problem. I don't know when they ditched the medication or when they were prescribed it, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I need to look more into it. I mean, this is a developing case, so a lot of things are happening really fast. And so you kind of feel like you're behind before you even know what's happening. And I definitely felt that way with the Summer Wells case. So I actually took a day and just went through all the Summer Wells stuff. And I spent so much time on it that I ended up making it into a YouTube video just because I'm like, okay, I have all this information. And this is literally just step by step what happened and what the parents had happened. And I ignored all the outside stuff and the this person and the that person and the psychic and the this. I was like, no, we're going to just hone in on what happened according to the family and what happened that they could prove in the Summer Wells case. And I actually it was interesting because I went into it absolutely convinced the parents were involved. And then I looked at the whole thing and I'm like, I don't think I honestly don't think they were. And I was kind of surprised, but sometimes you have to sit down and look at every piece and say, is this really, does this fit? Does this make any sense with whatever your preconceived notion is? With the Summer Wells case, it didn't. But I mean, I understand why people suspected them, because I did too. And I understand why people know every single detail of the case and still suspect them. I get it. But I just came out of it with leaning a different direction. But another case that I've been trying to catch up on is the Murdoch case out of South Carolina. What is even happening?
Such a confusing case. I listened to these two episodes on Sinisterhood about the case, and I sort of trying to explain it to my husband, and I'm like, this is just so convoluted and confusing. And then the most current event hadn't happened with the like attempted murder of the one. And I was just like, I can't even explain this to you. Like, you almost need to listen to it yourself, babe, because I can't break it down into a few sentences. Yeah.
It's a really confusing case. And I guess I just saw something that they had a housekeeper die in a trip and fall accident a couple years ago. And I'm like, wait, how many people are dying like in their vicinity, like in tragedies? And I think it's when I did listen to the Murdoch murder podcast, where it's a journalist who's in the area. So she knows people and she has information no one else has, which was really great. But I also found it still very confusing. I think, I don't know, I need someone to present it in a timeline for me. And I think that's what I'm missing. I'm missing the timeline. I'm getting all these pieces. And I just need to restructure it.
It feels fractured all over the place. Mm-hmm. Like, I left this going, I like to think I'm a reasonably intelligent person, but like, I just don't understand this. I feel like I need someone to give me the Murdoch murders for dummies, because I don't get it. And I think the housekeeper that the slip and fall, it was suggested in Sinisterhood that I can't remember what the boys, the son of the guy and his wife that were killed, that the son might have pushed her down the stairs. And I'm not saying that's what happened at all, but it was suggested that might have been like them covering it up. And I have no idea.
Yeah, because I know the son that was killed was also the same one who got in the allegedly drunken boat crash and a girl died in it, where that was like an accident, but he was driving recklessly because he was drunk and angry because he was raging at his girlfriend, who he, I don't know if I have to say allegedly if he's dead, because he can't sue me, but like, so according to the witnesses, he had hit his girlfriend and was screaming at her. Then he gets on the wheel and he's drunk and they're driving, and he like drives it just right into the piling or whatever. And people are ejected from the boat and one of them drowned. And so I'm like, okay, well, that's a pretty straightforward thing. But the next thing I know, okay, he's being murdered with his mom on some remote property while they were at the dog kennels on the property, and the dad finds them. And then he has this weird 911 call, and then someone tried to kill him, and now he's embezzled money allegedly, and they have a housekeeper who died. And it's just like, whoa, calm down. Like, there's just so many pieces, and I don't know that any of them go together, but obviously they're all linked by this one family.
It's so weird. And like, when the police responded to that boating accident, I think it was their body cams that they talked about on Sinisterhood, how they were basically saying, oh, like, you don't know who was driving, sort of like trying to, you know, push away the kids who were the witnesses from saying that, like, the Murdoch kid was the one that was driving. So at least there was like some element where the dad could later say, oh, you know, see, nobody made a statement at the scene. He wasn't driving. So later, if they say it, then it's like, well, they weren't even sure. They were all drinking. How can we be sure who was driving?
Yeah. And they said that on the Murdoch murders one that I listened to, they said that according to the other kids, because they have all these depositions, and according to them, Alec Murdoch, or Alec, however he says it, while his son was in the hospital, he was trying to get into the rooms of all the other kids. And the parents were like, no, you need to like leave my kid alone. And they were like, why is he trying to get to all the other kids while they're laid up in a hospital and a woman is missing? A young woman is missing. Why is his concern getting to all the witnesses? Like, shouldn't he be at his own kid's bedside? You know, so it It's really that case is confusing. And I feel like even discussing it's probably just confusing listeners.
Oh, yeah. If anybody hasn't listened to it, I'll, you know, link the Murdoch murders and the Sinisterhood episodes, yeah, because I'm sure we're not sounding very cohesive or easy to understand here. But don't expect it to be any easier or better when you're listening to the episodes, because it's just as confusing.
Absolutely. It is just as confusing.
Like, I don't know what the motive would have been for the murdering of, you know, his wife and Alec. Mm-hmm. It's Alec, spelled Alex, but pronounced Alec, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's confusing. Yeah, and
it's actually not even Alec. It's like, ugh. Like the way they say it, I thought between the Murdoch and the Alec, I was like, so they must be Scottish, right? But then I heard the 911 call and I'm like, no, that's the most South Carolina accent I've ever heard in my life. Like, so no, obviously he's not from Scotland, but they apparently pronounce their names that way. I don't get it. But it was funny because in the Murdoch Murders podcast, she makes a little bit of a snarky reference to, she can tell which journalists haven't actually talked to anybody in town because they all say the name wrong. She's like, I can tell. It was kind of funny.
Yeah, it's one of those names where the way it's spelled, it's like Murdoch, like, oh,
yeah,
like it's weird. And then it's like, okay, this is pronounced, because my husband had brought it up to me. He saw an article. He's like, have you heard about this? He's like, I don't know how to say this name, like Murdoch.
Yeah, I would have said Murdoch when I saw it. And then, but then I think I saw a tweet where someone made a comment about them not, about how they say the name, or, oh, I think it was a tweet about Nancy Grace mispronouncing it. And it was annoying whoever it was who watched Nancy Grace mispronounce it. And I was like, wait, how do you pronounce it? And then I thought, okay, I need to listen to this podcast anyway, because I need to know what people are talking about. And I just keep seeing all these articles being posted and I have no idea what any of it means because it's so confusing. But I have caught up, but I'm not a whole lot less. I'm still pretty confused.
Oh, I'm still confused. I'm right there with you.
Yeah, none of it makes a lot of sense.
I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all. If any of you have anything to say about the case, any thoughts, you can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. Or I'm really, really active on Twitter, so please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story. And it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.